Good morning, everyone. I hope you have had a wonderful 4th of July weekend. Lots of hamburgers, hot dogs, fireworks. Hopefully, your dogs weren't terrified like ours were of the fireworks. So this morning we get to we have a really exciting topic actually to talk about. Are you ready? So it's rejection. What do we do with rejection when, like, the job that you were really hoping for and you're interviewed and you don't get it? Or when you take a chance and you submit your poetry or your writing for publication and you get like a form email in response? Or let's say you apply for a loan to finally start the business, the idea that you've been dreaming about, and your credit's not good enough and you get turned down. Or what if, like, you finally get up the courage to ask him or her out for coffee and you get a polite but uncomfortable, "No thanks." What do you do with that? Yikes. So I actually heard a story on this podcast, Invisibilia, about a guy who made a game out of rejection. And it's this guy, Jason Comley. He lives in Ontario, and he's a freelance IT guy. And he tells a story of his wife actually leaving him for another man. And this other man he described as taller, better looking, having more money than he did. And he had just, in the fallout, he had just kind of turned into this recluse. He wasn't hanging out with friends. He was spending all his time alone in his apartment. And he realized, that he was afraid, right? And he realized that the only solution for him was to conquer this fear. And how was he going to do it? He had to get rejected. A lot, like every day. So he decided, I'm gonna get rejected every single day, at least once. More is a bonus. And so his first attempt, he went up to this guy in a parking lot and he said, "Hey, I need a ride across town. Can you help me?" And the guy was like, "Sorry, man, not going that way." And he was like, "Thanks. Awesome." And he was practicing what psychotherapists actually call exposure therapy, where you expose yourself repeatedly to the thing that you're afraid of. So let's say you're afraid of flying, or you're afraid of small mammals with really long tails. You expose yourself to that thing and you realize, oh, it can't actually hurt you, right? And so he ended up actually, he did this over time and he ended up starting to print up these cards. And created this game called Rejection Therapy, which is now apparently played all over the world. You can, get online and order your own copy. And here's a few of the examples. Convince a stranger you know them. Before purchasing something, ask for a discount. Or on the next one, challenge a stranger to rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock. Is that a thing? I don't know if it's a thing. Request a lower interest rate from a credit card provider, etc. So he actually has some advice for us. Are you ready? Okay. He says, just get out there and get rejected. And sometimes it's gonna get dirty, but that's okay. Because you're gonna feel great after. You're gonna be like, wow, I disobeyed fear. Right? So, today, we're gonna get to see something that happens when Jesus experiences rejection. And we're gonna get to see what he does with it when the people closest to him, when those he's actually grown up with, reject him. And in the process, we're gonna get a chance to see something really essential about the mystery of faith by understanding what it was that caused them to doubt Jesus and how Jesus responds to it. And our text is Mark 6, and I invite you to read along with me. Okay, here's what's been happening. Just before this, he had encountered this woman, and the woman had a hemorrhage for 12 years. Can you imagine? And she was, because of the bleeding, she was actually ceremonially unclean, which meant she couldn't take part in temple worship for that entire time. So she's sick, she's in pain, she's isolated, and not only that, but she had spent all of her money on doctors and still wasn't better. And Jesus healed her. And then there was the synagogue official, and his daughter was really sick, and he came to Jesus and he said, "Will you come?" And Jesus said, "Yes, I'll come." And he, as they began to make their way, some friends nearby that lived nearby came and said, "Don't bother the teacher anymore. She's already gone. It's too late." But Jesus, he went anyway, and he pushed past the mourners that were outside, and he went into the room where she was, and he spoke to her lifeless body, and she got up. And then he went home. He left that place and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. They said, "Where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that's been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters right here with us?" And they took offense at him. See, they've been hearing all these crazy stories. And now here he is, back in person. And at first they're impressed, right? He's teaching with this authority. And apparently he's been healing people like Elijah has done. And they had heard he had even been casting out demons, as Solomon was rumored to have been able to do. And they start wondering, maybe he really is a prophet like his cousin John was. Maybe he's the one we've been waiting for. The one Moses promised, because Moses had said, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You shall heed such a prophet." But that's when they remember. "We knew this guy when he was a kid. We remember when he was 13 and his voice was changing. And here's his family right here with us. He's not a prophet. He's just like us. He, by the way, he isn't even very well educated. He's blue collar. He's a carpenter." See, he wasn't what they thought that a prophet sent by God would be. And so they rejected Jesus because he did not meet their expectations. And I have to tell you that as a woman in the church, in ministry, in church work, I really get this. There have been places where I haven't been welcome because of who I am, that my gifts have not been acceptable, right? I remember when I first told my mom that I was going to start preaching, and one of her first thoughts was of my great-grandfather, Daniel Washington Whitfield. I don't know if you can see him and his piercing eyes from the back of the room. He looks like a pretty fun guy, right? And my mom said, "Oh, your great-grandfather, he would have been so proud of you." And then she kind of stopped. And she was like, "Well, actually, maybe he wouldn't be." And we kind of laughed awkwardly because, you know, we knew the reality was he probably wouldn't have been okay with me wearing pants and having my ears pierced, much less preaching, right? But then my mom said this great thing. she said, but I bet he's proud now. And it makes me think, it makes me think of the reality that God actually loves to use all of us, right? And I think he has a special affinity for the unexpected, those who might be overlooked the least, right? There are a few stories about that. Because see, I think the people in Jesus' hometown, I think they had forgotten the story of their great King David, because he was the youngest, right? He was a shepherd. He showed up in town, this punk kid. And he was the one, though, that killed Goliath. And he became this amazing king and walked with God. And we still sing his songs today. But when he first showed up, he got laughed at in his armor that was three sizes too big because he wasn't what they expected. And I wonder, when has God been something you didn't expect? When has God not been what you hoped for? Maybe even disappointed you or offended you? Is that even allowed? And I wonder, what do you do with that feeling when it happens? Because I think it does happen. Then Jesus said to them, prophets are not without honor except in their hometown, among their own kin, and in their own house. And he could do no deed of power there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and cured them. And he was amazed at their unbelief. When Luke tells this same story, he actually says that they liked Jesus' teaching until he started talking about showing mercy to people that they didn't actually want to show mercy to people who had been their oppressors, to people who weren't part of them. And suddenly it got a lot easier to think, you know, maybe all these fantastic stories, maybe they're not true. Maybe he's just putting on airs and pretending to be something he's not, right? And I would think in that moment, I would think that Jesus would just kind of like smite them or something, or that he would shrug his shoulders and move on to bigger and better things. But he doesn't do that. He's actually moved by their doubt. It surprised him, and it influenced the way that he was able to work and to be among them. Mark writes that he could do no deed of power there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and cured them. See, their doubt, their rejection, it impacted him in this real way. And that makes me wonder, like, what is faith? What is belief? What does it actually look like? You know, C.S. Lewis talks about the time that he came to faith. And he actually came to it through his search for something that he called joy. And it was this kind of elusive thing, something beautiful and beyond himself that he had experienced on and off throughout his boyhood. And he was pretty sure it had absolutely nothing to do with God, since he didn't believe God existed. And yet, as a student and later as a professor at Oxford, he started meeting these interesting and intelligent people who were Christians. And he almost talks about God as like stalking him. And as he describes like the process of just dipping his toe in, just starting to explore leaning into faith, he describes it this way. He says, without words, and I think almost without images, a fact about myself was somehow presented to me. I became aware that I was holding something at bay or shutting something out. No threat or promise was attached to either, though I knew that to open the door meant the incalculable. So for him, faith, it was this non-linear thing. It was a mystery. It was beyond reason. And his description reminds me of this father who asked Jesus for his help, for his little girl, for his, not his little girl, his son. I have a little girl. So, and he says, you know, Jesus, if you could do anything, if you could possibly help, that would be so great. If you can, please help. And Jesus says, if? And then the dad says this great thing. He says, I believe. Help my unbelief. So somehow, apparently, faith and not faith can coexist. It's good news, right? And when he said, I believe, help my unbelief, he wasn't talking about knowing something. He wasn't saying, I understand all of this. I don't have any more questions. He was simply, desperately, honestly welcoming Jesus and Jesus' work in this essential way. And Jesus said yes to that kind of shaky, uncertain faith. Healed the boy. And the word that the dad uses for unbelief, it's the same word that's used to describe Jesus' amazement at the unbelief from the people in his hometown. It's a word that can mean weakness of faith. And for us, I wonder, what keeps our faith weak sometimes? What makes it hard for us to believe? I wonder if part of the problem is that maybe we've gotten this idea that faith is something that we're supposed to will ourselves into, or that it means certainty. And I wonder, too, if part of it is that we try to do it by ourselves. That's why it can be so hard at times. There's this great interview with Nadia Boltz-Weber where she says this. She says, I don't think faith is given in sufficient quantity to individuals necessarily. I think it's given in sufficient quantity to communities. What if we need each other and help each other? Well, let's see what happens next. Then he went about among the villages teaching, and he called the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. And he ordered them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. And he said to them, wherever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that place. And if any place will not welcome you and they refuse to hear you as you leave, shake off the dust that's on your feet as a testimony against them. So they went out and proclaimed that all should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and cured them. So Jesus actually didn't let the doubt of others, even those he'd known the longest, define him. He was able to move through, and he did move through, the surprise and the disappointment because he knew who he was and why he had come. He had come to proclaim the kingdom, a new kingdom. He'd come to invite people to turn toward God. He had come to heal. He had come to set people free. And the people's rejection didn't shake Jesus' confidence in that calling, in that purpose. And so, from his own experience, he taught his friends, and he passed on that calling to them, and he taught them to expect that some would be ready and willing to receive their message, and some wouldn't. That some would be willing to receive their help and their healing, and some wouldn't. But that didn't have to stop them. And it didn't. It says they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and cured them. There's this guy, Bartolome de las Casas. I hope that I didn't butcher his name, but he's been gone a long time, so hopefully he'll give grace if so. He was one of the very first Spaniards to come to the New World, what's now Central America. And, you know, he knew Columbus, no big deal. And he had this huge plantation on what is now the island where Haiti and the Dominican Republic are. And on this plantation, he didn't just have slaves. He captured them himself with his dad's help. And he was really confident, as many were at that time, that the natives are naturally inferior and they're pagan. Therefore, they should probably be slaves. Let's do that. And he even argued with a priest who was preaching against slavery. He was like, no, sorry, you've got this all wrong. And then he even became a priest. We have a drawing of him here. He even became a priest and still was okay with the whole owning other people thing for a while. Until one day he was actually preparing to teach a sermon. And suddenly, God just revealed and he realized these people who I consider property, they're made in God's image just like I am. And so he released his slaves and he started trying to get other people to release their slaves. And he got on a boat and went back to Spain. And he went before King Ferdinand and Charles V and tried to get the laws changed. But unfortunately, there was a problem. And that problem was that those slaves and all the labor that they were doing was bringing in a lot of money for a lot of people, including, by the way, the kings that he was talking to. And so he turned to writing, and he started writing these books, and he talked about the atrocities that he'd seen. Here's a sleeve from one of the pages. And what happened was that he was accused of treason. He was, some of his books were burned. He was denounced before the Spanish Inquisition. And through it all, though, he never stopped saying for the rest of his life, all people of the world are humans. He never stopped saying that because he knew that God had called him to invite people to turn toward God. And he knew that God had called him to be about the business of setting people free. And maybe, remembering how he had once been so sure that slavery was okay before God showed him the truth, maybe that helped him get through all of the resistance he faced. I don't know. And for us, I wonder what it would be like if we realized that Jesus can actually handle our doubts and our wrestling and even our rejection. What if, What if we could actually trust that God can keep working in spite of us, even when we're fighting on the wrong side at times? That he's still working, still inviting? And I wonder what that faith might look like. One that is maybe messy, but real and lived together. One where we realize that there's something that won't let us go. Where maybe we'd be able to say like Peter, where else are we going to go? You have the words of life. Because the truth is, faith is, it's a process. And it's complicated, right? And I'm more convinced than ever that we need each other to do it well. We need each other to walk it out. And Jesus can handle not meeting our expectations. He can handle our doubt and even our rejection, even as it moves him, even as he keeps inviting us closer, further up and further in. Yeah. And the reality is that rejection, it doesn't get to have the last word. Because, as you know, Jesus' own family was in full agreement with much of what his hometown folks were saying. They thought he was crazy. They thought he'd lost his mind. But sometime between his death and resurrection and the first days of the early church, his brother James ended up being the leader of the Christian church in Jerusalem while Peter and Paul were out on their journeys. So at some point, he became convinced that Jesus was who he said he was. It's pretty amazing. But the good news, the best news, is that Jesus actually turns rejection into redemption. It was actually the plan all along for us. Because we know the religious authorities rejected him. The people rejected him, asked for a murderer to be released instead. Peter denied ever having met him. And even the father who he loved and who loved him turned his face away. And it seemed that the darkness had won. But it hadn't. Will you pray with me? God of grace and powerful weakness, at times you were ignored, rejected, belittled, and unwelcome. Fill us with your spirit and support us by your gentle hands that we may persevere in speaking your word and living our faith together. Amen.